And you are? The guardian smiles. Not an Orogen, I gather, despite your uniform. Beanoff jumps a little, as if she's forgotten that she's been playing Little Lost Grit. Oh. She straightens and lifts her chin. My name is Beanoff Leadership Eumenis. Your pardon for my intrusion, Guardian. I had a question that required an answer. Beanoff's talking differently, Demaya realizes suddenly. Her words evenly spaced and voice steady. Her manner not so much haughty as grave. As if the world's fate depends upon her finding the answer to her question. As if she isn't just some spoiled girl from a powerful family who decided on a whim to do something incredibly stupid. The guardian stops, cocking her head and blinking as her smile momentarily fades. Leadership, Eumenis? Then she beams.
How lovely! So young, and already you have a calm name. You are quite welcome among us, Beanoff Leader. If you had but told us you were coming, we could have shown you what you wanted to see.
Beanoff flinches minutely at the rebuke. I had a wish to see it for myself, I'm afraid. Perhaps that was not wise, but my parents are likely by now aware that I've come here. So please feel free to speak to them about it. It's a smart thing to do, Demaya is surprised to realize, because before now she has not thought of Beanoff as smart. Mentioning that others know where she's gone.
I shall,
says the guardian, and then she smiles at Demaya, which makes her stomach tighten.
And I shall speak to your guardian, and we shall all speak together. That would be lovely, yes?
Yes, please. She steps aside and bows a little, gesturing for them to precede her. And as polite as it looks, they both know it's not a request. The guardian leads them out of the chamber. As they all step into the brick tunnel again, the lights go out behind them. When the door is shut and the office is closed and they have proceeded into the guardian's wing, the woman touches Demaya's shoulder to stop her while Beanoff keeps walking for a step or two. Then when Beanoff stops, looking at them in confusion, the guardian says to Demaya,
Please wait here.
Then she moves to rejoin Beanoff. Beanoff looks at her, perhaps trying to convey something with her eyes. Demaya looks away, and the message fails as the guardian leads her farther down the hall and into a closed door. Beanoff has already done enough harm. Demaya waits, of course. She's not stupid. She's standing in front of the door to a busy area. Despite the hour, other guardians emerge now and again and look at her. She doesn't look back, and something in this seems to satisfy them, so they move on without bothering her. After a few moments, the guardian who caught them in the pit chamber returns and leads her through the door with a gentle hand on her shoulder.
Now, let's just talk a bit, why don't we? I've sent for Shafa. Fortunately, he's in the city right now, and not out on circuit as usual. But until he gets here...
There's a large, handsomely apportioned carpeted area beyond the door, with many small desks. Some are occupied and some not, and the people who move between them wear a mix of black and burgundy uniforms. Very few aren't wearing uniforms at all, but civilian clothing. Demaya stares at all of it in fascination, until the guardian puts a hand on her head and gently, but inexorably, steers her gaze away. Demaya is led into a small private office at the end of this chamber. The desk here is completely empty, however, and the room has a disused air. There's a chair on either side of the desk, so Demaya takes the one meant for guests.
I'm sorry, she says as the guardian sits down behind the desk. I didn't think.
The guardian shakes her head as if this doesn't matter.
Did you touch any of them?
What?
In the socket.
The guardian's still smiling. But they always smile. This means nothing useful.
You saw the extrusions from the socket walls? Weren't you curious? There was one only an arm's length below where you stood.
Socket? Oh, and the iron bits poking out of the walls.
No, I didn't touch any of them.
Socket for what? The guardian sits forward, and abruptly her smile vanishes. It doesn't fade, and she doesn't frown to replace it. All the expression just stops in her face.
Did it call to you? Did you answer?
Something's wrong. Damaya feels this suddenly, instinctively, and the realization dries the words from her mouth. The guardian even sounds different. Her voice is deeper, softer, almost hushed, as if she's saying something she doesn't want the others to hear.
What did it say to you?
The guardian extends her hand, and even though Damaya puts her hand out immediately in obedient response, she does not want to. She does it anyway, because guardians are to be obeyed. The woman takes Demaya's hand and holds it palm up, her thumb stroking the long crease, the lifeline.
You can tell me.
Demaya shakes her head in utter confusion.
What did what say to me?
It's angry. The woman's voice drops lower, going monotonous. And Damaya realizes she's not trying to go unheard anymore. The guardian is talking differently, because that's not her voice. Angry and afraid. I hear both gathering, growing, the anger and the fear, readying for the time of return. It's like someone else is inside the guardian, and that is who's talking. Except using the guardian's face and voice and everything else. But as the woman says this, her hand begins to tighten on Demaya's. Her thumb, which rests right on the bones that Shafa broke a year and a half ago, begins to press in. And Damaya feels faint as some part of her thinks, I don't want to be hurt again.
I'll tell you whatever you want, she offers.
But the guardian keeps pressing. It's like she doesn't even hear. It did what it had to do, last time. Press and tighten. This guardian, unlike Shafa, has longer nails. The thumbnail begins to dig into Demaya's flesh. It seeped through the walls and tainted their pure creation. Exploited them before they could exploit it. When the arcane connections were made, it changed those who would control it. Chained them, fate to fate.
Please don't, Damaya whispers.
Her palm has begun to bleed. In almost the same moment, there is a knock at the door. The woman ignores both. It made them a part of it.
I don't understand, Damaya says. It hurts. It hurts. She's shaking, waiting for the snap of bone.
It hoped for communion. Compromise, instead. The battle. Escalated.
I don't understand. You're not making any sense.
It's wrong. Damaya's raising her voice to a guardian, and she knows better, but this isn't right. Shafa promised that he would hurt her only for a good reason. All guardians operate on this principle. Damaya has seen the proof of it in how they interact with her fellow Grits and the Ringed Origins. There is an order to life in the fulcrum, and this woman is breaking it.
Let go of me! I'll do whatever you want, just let go!
The door opens, and Shafa flows in. Damaya's breath catches, but he doesn't look at her. His gaze is fixed on the guardian who holds Damaya's hand. He isn't smiling as he moves to stand behind her.
Timei? Control yourself.
Timei's not home, Damaya thinks. It speaks, Only to warn now, she continues in a drone. There will be no compromise next time. Shafa sighs a little, then jabs his fingers into the back of Timae's skull. It's not clear at first from Demaya's angle that this is what he's done. She just sees him make a sudden, sharp, violent movement, and then Timae's head jerks forward. She makes a sound so harsh and guttural that it is almost vulgar, and her eyes go wide. Shafa's face is expressionless as he does something, his arm flexing, and that's when the first bloodlines wend around Timae's neck, beginning to sink into her tunic and patter into her lap. Her hand on Demaya's relaxes all at once, and her face goes slack. That is also when Demaya begins to scream. She keeps screaming as Shafa twists his hand again, nostrils flaring with the effort of whatever he's doing, and the sound of crunching bone and popping tendon is undeniable. Then Shafa lifts his hand, holding something small and indistinct, too covered in gore between his thumb and forefinger. Timae falls forward then, and now Demaya sees the ruin that was once the base of her skull. Be silent, little one, Shafa says mildly, and Demaya shuts up. Another guardian comes in, looks at Timae, looks at Shafa, and sighs. Unfortunate. Very unfortunate. Shafa offers the blood-covered thing to this man, who cups his hands to receive it carefully. I would like this removed. He nods toward Timae's body. Yes. The man leaves with the thing Shafa took from Timae, and then two more guardians come in, sigh as the first one did, and collect her body from its chair. They drag her out, one of them pausing to mop up with a handkerchief the drops of blood from the table where Timae fell. It's all very efficient. Shafa sits down in Timae's place, and Demaya jerks her eyes to him only because she must. They gaze at each other in silence for a few moments. Let me see, Shafa says gently, and she offers him her hand. Amazingly, it does not shake. He takes it with his left hand, the one that is still clean, because it did not rip out Timae's brain stem. He turns her hand, examining it carefully, making a face at the crescent of blood where Timae's thumbnail broke the skin. A single drop of Demaya's blood rolls off the edge of her hand, splatting onto the table right where Timae's blood had been a moment before. Good. I was afraid she'd hurt you worse than this. What? Demaya begins. She can't muster any more than that. Shafa smiles, though this is edged with sorrow. Something you should not have seen. What? This takes a 10-ringer's effort. Shafa considers a moment, then says, You are aware that we guardians are different. He smiles as if to remind her of how different. All guardians smile a lot. She nods, mute. There is a procedure. He lets go of her hand for a moment, touches the back of his own skull, beneath the fall of his long black hair. A thing is done to make us what we are. An implantation. Sometimes it goes wrong and must then be removed, as you saw. He shrugs. His right hand is still covered in gore. The guardian's connections with his assigned origins can help to stave off the worst. But Timae had allowed hers to erode. Foolish. A chilly barn in the Nomid Lats, a moment of apparent affection, two warm fingers pressed to the base of Demaya's skull. Duty first, he had said then. Something that will make me more comfortable. Demaya licks her lips. She was saying things, not making sense.
I heard some of what she said.
She wasn't... her. Now Demaya's the one not making sense. She wasn't who she was anymore. I mean, she was someone else, talking as if someone else was there.
In her head, in her mouth, speaking through it.
She kept talking about a socket and it being angry.
Shafa inclines his head. Father Earth, of course. It is a common delusion.
Demaya blinks.
What? It's angry? What?
And you're right. Team A wasn't herself any longer. I'm sorry she hurt you. I'm sorry you had to see that. I'm so sorry, little one.
And there is such genuine regret in his voice, such compassion in his face, that Demaya does what she is not since a cold, dark night in a Nomidlat's barn. She begins to cry. After a moment, Shafa gets up and comes around the table and picks her up, sitting in the chair and letting her curl in his lap to weep on his shoulder. There is an order to life in the fulcrum, see? And it is this. If one has not displeased them, the guardians are the closest thing to safety a Raga will ever have. So Demaya cries for a long time, not just because of what she's seen tonight. She cries because she has been inexpressibly lonely, and Shafa, well, Shafa loves her in his tender and terrifying way. She does not pay attention to the bloody print his right hand leaves on her hip, or the press of his fingers, fingers strong enough to kill, against the base of her skull. Such things are irrelevant in the grand scale. When the storm of weeping subsides, though, Shafa strokes her back with his clean hand.
How are you feeling, Demaya?
She does not lift her head from his shoulder. He smells of sweat and leather and iron, things that she will forever associate with comfort and fear. I'm all right.
Good. I need you to do something for me.
What?
He squeezes her gently, encouragingly. I'm going to take you down the hall to one of the crucibles, and there you will face the first ring test. I need you to pass it for me.
Demaya blinks, frowning, and lifts her head. He smiles at her tenderly. By this, she understands in a flash of intuition, that this is a test of more than her orogeny. After all, most Ragas are told of the test in advance so that they can practice and prepare. This is happening for her now, without warning, because it is her only chance. She has proven herself disobedient, unreliable. Because of this, Demaya will need to also prove herself useful. If she cannot...
I need you to live, Demaya.
Shafa touches his forehead to her own.
My compassionate one. My life is so full of death. Please, pass this test for me.
There are so many things she wants to know. What Timei meant, what will happen to Beanoff, what is the socket and why was it hidden? What happened to Crack last year? Why Shafa is even giving her this much of a chance? But there is an order to life in the fulcrum, and her place within it is not to question a guardian's will. But. She turns her head and looks at that single drop of her blood on the table. This is not right.
Demaya?
It isn't right what they're doing to her. What this place does to everyone within its walls. What he's making her do to survive.
Will you do it for me?
She still loves him. That isn't right either. If I pass... Demaya closes her eyes. She can't look at him and say this, not without letting him see the "it isn't right" in her eyes. I picked a Raga name.
He does not chide her on her language. Have you now? He sounds pleased.
What?
She licks her lips. Cyanide. Shafa sits back in the chair, sounding thoughtful.
I like it.
You do?
Of course I do. You chose it, didn't you?
He's laughing, but in a good way. With her, not at her.
It forms at the edge of a tectonic plate. With heat and pressure, it does not degrade, but instead grows stronger.
He does understand. She bites her lip and feels fresh tears threaten. It isn't right that she loves him, but many things in the world are not right. So she fights off the tears and makes her decision. Crying is weakness. Crying was a thing Demaya did. Cyanide will be stronger.
I'll do it,
Cyanide says softly. I'll pass the test for you, Shafa, I promise.
My good girl,
Shafa says and smiles, holding her close. Obscured, those who would take the earth too closely unto themselves. They are not masters of themselves. Allow them no mastery of others. From Tablet 2, The Incomplete Truth, Verse 9. 18. You discover wonders down below. Ika takes you into the house from which she and her companions emerged. There's little furniture inside, and the walls are bare. There's scuffing on the floor and walls, a lingering smell of food and stale body musk. Someone did live here until recently. Maybe until the season began. The house is only a shell now, though, as you and the others cut through to a cellar door. At the bottom of the steps, you find a large, empty chamber lit only by wood-pitch torches. Here's where you first start to realize this is more than just a bizarre community of people and not people. The walls of the cellar are solid granite. Nobody quarries into granite just to build a cellar, and you're not sure anyone dug this. Everyone stops while you go to one of the walls and touch it. You close your eyes and reach. Yes, there is the feel of something familiar here. Some raga shaped this perfectly smooth wall, using will and a focus finer than you can imagine. Though not the finest focus you've ever assessed. You've never heard of anyone doing anything like this with the Rajani. It's not for building. Turning, you see Ika watching you. Your work? She smiles. No, this and other hidden entrances have been around for centuries, long before me. The people in this calm have worked with Origins for that long? She'd said the calm was only 50 years old. Ika laughs. No, I just mean that this world has passed through many hands down the seasons. Not all of them were quite as stupid as ours about the usefulness of origins. We aren't stupid about it now, you say. Everyone understands perfectly well how to use us. Ooh. Ika grimaces pityingly. Fulcrum trained? The ones who survive it always seem to sound like you. You wonder how many fulcrum trained origins this woman has met. Yes.
Well, now you'll see how much more we're capable of when we're willing.
And Ika gestures toward a wide opening in the wall a few feet beyond her, which you hadn't noticed in your fascination with the cellar's construction. A faint draft wafts into the cellar from beyond it. There are also three people loitering at the mouth of the opening, watching you with varied expressions of hostility, wariness, amusement. They're not carrying any weapons. Those are propped against the wall nearby. And they're not conspicuous about it. But you realize these are the gate guards this comm should have. For the gate this comm doesn't have. Here, in this cellar. The blonde woman speaks quietly with one of the guards. This emphasizes even more how tiny she is. A foot shorter, and probably 100 pounds lighter than the smallest of them. Her ancestors really should have done her a few favors, and slept with a sunset or two. Anyway, then you move on, and the guards stay behind, two taking seats on chairs nearby, the third heading back up the steps, presumably to keep a lookout from within the empty building's topside. You make the paradigm shift, then. The abandoned village up there is this comm's wall. Camouflage, rather than a barrier. Camouflage for what, though? You follow Ika through the opening and into the dark beyond.
The core of this place has always been here, she explains, as you walk down a long dark tunnel that might be an abandoned mine shaft.
There's tracks for carts, though they're so old and sunken into the gritty stone that you can't really see them. Just awkward ridges beneath your feet. The wooden bracers of the tunnel look old, as do the wall sconces that hold cord-strung electric lights. They look like they were originally made to hold wooden torches and got retrofitted by some engineer. The lights are still working, which means the comms got functional geo or hydro or both. Better than Terimo already. It's warm in the shaft, too. But you don't see any of the usual heating pipes. It's just warm, and getting warmer as you follow the gently sloping floor downward.
I told you there were mines in the area. That's how they found these back in the day. Someone cracked a wall they shouldn't have, and blundered into a whole warren of tunnels nobody knew were there.
Ika falls silent for a long while as the shaft widens out, and you all go down a set of dangerous-looking metal steps. There's a lot of them. They look old, too. And yet, strangely, the metal doesn't seem distressed or rusted out. It's smooth and shiny and all over whole. The steps aren't shaky at all. After a time you notice, belatedly, that the red-haired stone-eater is gone. She didn't follow you down into the shaft. Ika doesn't seem to notice, so you touch her arm. Where's your friend? Though you sort of know.
My, oh, that one. Moving the way we do is hard for them. So they've got their own ways of getting about, including ways I would never have guessed.
She glances at Hoa, who's come down the steps with you. He looks back at her coldly, and she breathes out a laugh.
Interesting.
At the bottom of the stairs, there's another tunnel, though it looks different for some reason. Curved at its top, rather than squared, and the supports are some sort of thick, silvery stone columns, which arch partway up the walls like ribs. You can almost taste the age of these corridors through the pores of your skin.
Ika resumes. Really, all the bedrock in this area is riddled with tunnels and intrusions, mines on top of mines. One civilization after another, building on what went before.
Aritasid, says Tonki. Jamaria, the lower Ari states.
You've heard of Jamaria from the history you used to teach in creche. It was the name of a large nation, the one that started the road system Sansa later improved upon, and which once spread over most of what is now the Somid Lats. It died around 10 seasons ago. The rest of the names are probably those of other dead civs. That seems like the sort of thing geomests would care about, even if no one else does.
Dangerous, you say, as you try not to be too obvious with your unease. If the rock here's been compromised so much, yes, though that's a risk with any mining, as much because of incompetence as shakes.
Tonki is turning and turning as she walks, taking it all in, and still not bumping into anyone. Amazing.
That northern shake was severe enough that even this should have come down, she says.
You're right. That shake. We're calling it the Humanus Rifting,
since nobody's come up with a better name yet, was the worst the world's seen in an age. I don't think I'm exaggerating by saying so. Ika shrugs and glances back at you. But of course the tunnels didn't collapse because I was here. I didn't let them. You nod slowly. It's no different than what you did for Turimo, except Ika must have taken care to protect more than just the surface. The area must be relatively stable anyway, or these tunnels would have all collapsed ages ago. But you say, you won't always be around.
When I'm not, someone else will do it, she shrugs. Like I said, there's a lot of us here now.
About that. Tonki pivots on one foot, and suddenly her whole attention is on Ika. Ika laughs.
Kind of single-minded, aren't you?
Not really. You suspect Tonki is still simultaneously taking note of the supports and wall composition, counting your paces, whatever, all while she talks.
So how are you doing it?
Luring origins here.
Luring? Ika shakes her head.
It's not that sinister, and it's hard to describe. There's a thing I do, like...
She falls silent. And all at once, you stumble while you're walking. There's no obstruction on the floor. It's just suddenly difficult to walk in a straight line, as if the floor has developed an invisible downward slope. Toward Ika. You stop and glare at her. She stops as well, turning to smile at you.
How are you doing that? You demand.
I don't know.
She spreads her hands at your disbelieving look.
It's just something I tried a few years ago, and not too long after I started doing it. A man came to town and said he'd felt me from miles away. Then two kids showed up. They didn't even realize what they were reacting to. Then another man. I've kept doing it since.
Doing what? Tonki asks, looking from you to Ika.
Only Rogars feel it. Ika explains, though by this point you've figured that out for yourself.
Then she glances at Hoa, who is watching both of you, utterly still.
And them, I realized later.
About that, Tonki blurts.
Earth fires and rust buckets, you ask too many questions.
This comes from the blonde woman, who shakes her head and gestures for all of you to keep walking.
There are faint, occasional noises up ahead now, and the air is moving, noticeably. How can that be? You must be a mile down, maybe twice that. The breeze is warm and tinged with scents you've almost forgotten after weeks of breathing sulfur and ash through a mask. A bit of cooking food here, a waft of rotting garbage there, a breath of burning wood. People. You're smelling people, lots of them. And there's a light, much stronger than the strings of electric lights along the walls. Straight ahead.
An underground comm?
Tonki says what you're thinking, though she sounds more skeptical. You know more about impossible things than she does.
No. Nobody's that stupid.
Ika only laughs. Then, as the peculiar light starts to brighten the shaft around you, and the air moves faster and the noise grows, there's a place where the tunnel opens out and becomes a wide ledge with a metal railing for safety. A scenic viewpoint, because some engineer or innovator understood exactly how newcomers would react. You do exactly as that long-ago designer intended. You stare in open-mouthed, abject wonder. It's a geode. You can sense that. The way the rock around you abruptly changes to something else. The pebble in the stream, the warp in the weft. Countless eons ago, a bubble formed in a flow of molten mineral within Father Earth. Within that pocket, nurtured by incomprehensible pressures and bathed in water and fire, crystals grew. This one's the size of a city. which is probably why someone built a city in this one.
You stand before a vast, vaulted cavern that is full of glowing crystal shafts the size of tree trunks. Big tree trunks. Or buildings.
Big buildings.
They jut forth from the walls in an utterly haphazard jumble. Different lengths, different circumferences, some white and translucent, and a few smoky or tinged with purple. Some are stubby, their pointed tips ending only a few feet away from the walls that grew them. But many stretch from one side of the vast cavern into the indistinct distance. They form struts and roads too steep to climb, going in directions that make no sense. It's as if someone found an architect, made her build a city out of the most beautiful materials available, then threw all those buildings into a box and jumbled them up for laughs. And they're definitely living in it. As you stare, you notice narrow rope bridges and wooden platforms everywhere. There are dangling lines strung with electric lanterns, ropes and pulleys, carrying small lifts from one platform to another. In the distance, a man walks down a wooden stairway built around a titanic slanted column of white. Two children play on the ground far below, in between stubby crystals, the size of houses. Actually, some of the crystals are houses. They have holes cut in them, doors and windows. You can see people moving around inside some of them. Smoke curls from chimney holes cut in pointed crystal tips. "Evil, eating, earth," you whisper. Yika stands with hands on her hips, watching your reaction with something like pride in her expression.
"We didn't do most of this," she admits. "The recent additions, the new abridges, yes. But the shaft hollowing had already been done. We don't know how they managed it without shattering the crystals. The walkways that are made of metal, it's the same stuff as the steps in the tunnels we just passed through. The Janiyas have no idea how it's made. Metallurgists and alchemists have orgasms when they see it. There are mechanisms up there." She points toward the barely visible ceiling of the cavern, hundreds of feet above your heads.
You barely hear her, your mind numb, your eyes beginning to ache from staring without blinking. That pump Badea into a layer of porous earth that filters and disperses it back onto the surface. Other pumps bring in good air. There are mechanisms just outside the geode that divert water from an underground hot spring a ways off through a turbine that gives us electric power. Took ages to figure that part out. And also bring it in for day-to-day use. She sighs. "But to be really honest, we don't know how half the stuff we found here works. All of it was built long ago, long before old Sansa ever existed."
"Geodes are unstable once their shells are breached."
Even Tonki sounds floored. In your peripheral vision, she is still. For the first time since you met her.
"It doesn't make sense to even think of building inside one. And why are the crystals glowing?"
She's right, they are. Ika shrugs, folding her arms.
"No idea. But the people who built this wanted it to last, even through a shake. So they did things to the geode to make sure that would happen. And it did. But they didn't. When people from Kastrima found this, it was full of skeletons. Some so old they turned to dust as soon as we touched them.
So your calm forebears decided to move everyone into a giant dead civ artifact that killed the last few people who risked it," you drawl. It's weak, Snark, though. You're too shaken to really get the tone right.
"Of course. Why not repeat a colossal mistake?
Believe me, it's been an ongoing debate."
Yika sighs and leans against the railing, which makes you twitch. It's a long way down if she slips,
and some of the crystals on the geode floor are sharp-looking. No one was willing to live here for a long time. Kastrima used this place and the tunnels leading to it as a store cache, though never for essentials like food or medicine. But in all that time, there's never been so much as a crack in the walls, even after shakes. We were further convinced by history. The calm that controlled this area during the last season, a real proper calm, with walls and everything, got overrun by a calmless band. The whole calm was burned to the ground, all their vital stores taken. The survivors had a choice between moving down here and trying to survive up there with no heat and no walls, and every bunch of scavengers around homing in on the easy pickings left. So they were our precedent. Necessity is the only law, says Stonelore. Not that it went well. Ika straightens and gestures for you to follow her again. All of you start down a broad, flat ramp that gently slopes toward the floor of the cavern. You realize only belatedly that it's a crystal, and you're walking down its side. Someone's paved the thing with concrete for traction, but past the edges of the gray strip, you can see softly glowing white. Most of the people who moved down here during that season died too. They couldn't make the air mechanisms work. Staying here for more than a few days at a time meant suffocation. And they didn't have any food. So even though they were warm and safe and had plenty of water, most of them starved before the sun returned. It's an old tale, freshened only by the unique setting. You nod absently, trying not to stumble as your attention is caught by an older man riding across the cavern while suspended from a pulley and cable, his butt snugly tucked into a loop of rope. Ika pauses to wave. The man waves back and glides on. The survivors of that nightmare started the trading post that eventually became Kastrima. They passed down stories about this place, but still, no one wanted to live here. Until my great-grandmother realized why the mechanisms didn't work. Until she got them working just by walking through that entrance. Ika gestures back the way you came. Worked for me, too, when I first came down here. You stop. Everyone goes on without you for a moment. Hoa is the first to notice that you're not following. He turns and looks at you. There is something guarded in his expression that was not there before, you notice distantly through horror and wonder. Later, when you've had time to get past this, you and he will have to talk. Now there are more important considerations. The mechanisms, you say. Your mouth is dry. They run on orogeny. Dika nods, half smiling. That's what the Janias think. Of course, the fact that it's all working now makes the conclusion obvious. Is it? You grope for the words, fail. How? Ika laughs, shaking her head. I have no idea. It just works. That, more than everything else she's shown you, terrifies you. Ika sighs and puts her hands on her hips. Esun, she says, and you twitch. That's your name, right? You lick your lips. Esun resists, and then you stop. Because you were about to give the name you gave to people in Tarima for years. And that name is a lie. Esun, you say again, and stop there. Limited lying. Ika glances at your companions. Tonki, innovator D-bars, says Tonki. She throws an almost embarrassed look at you, then looks down at her feet. Hoa, says Hoa. Ika gazes at him a moment longer, as if she expects more, but he offers nothing. Well then, Ika opens her arms, as if to encompass the whole geode. She gazes at all of you with her chin lifted, almost in defiance,
This is what we are trying to do here in Kastrima. Survive. Same as anyone. We're just willing to innovate a little.
She inclines her head to Tonki, who chuckles nervously.
We might all die doing it, but rust. That might happen anyway. It's a season.
You lick your lips. Can we leave?
What the rust do you mean, can we leave? We barely had time to explore.
Tonki begins, looking angry, and then abruptly realizes what you mean. Her sallow face grows more so.
Oh.
Yika's smile is sharp as diamond.
Well, you're not stupid, that's good. Come on. We've got some people to meet.
She beckons for you to follow again, resuming her walk down the slope.
And she does not answer your question.
In actual practice, the sesopinae, paired organs located at the base of the brainstem, have been found to be sensitive to far more than local seismic movements and atmospheric pressure. In tests, reactions have been observed to the presence of predators, to others' emotions, to distant extremes of heat or cold, and to the movements of celestial objects. The mechanism of these reactions cannot be determined.
Nandvid innovator Merketsi. Observations of sessional variation in overdeveloped individuals. 7th University Biomastery Learning Com. With appreciation to the Fulcrum for cadaver donation.
19. Cyanite, on the lookout. They've been in Mayov for 3 days, when something changes. Cyanite has spent those 3 days feeling very much out of place, in more ways than one. The first problem is that she can't speak the language, which Alabaster tells her is called Eterpic. A number of coaster comms still speak it as a native tongue, though most people also learn Sansamout for trading purposes. Alabaster's theory is that the people of the islands are mostly descended from coasters, which seems fairly obvious from their predominant coloring and common kinky hair. But since they raid rather than trade, they had no need to retain Sansamout. He tries to teach Eterpic to her, but she's not really in a learn-something-new sort of mood. That's because of the second problem, which Alabaster points out to her after they've had enough time to recover from their travails. They can't leave, or rather, they've got nowhere to go.
If the Guardians tried to kill us once, they'll try again, he explains.
This is as they stroll along one of the arid heights of the island. It's the only way they can get any real privacy, since otherwise, hordes of children follow them around and try to imitate the strange sounds of Sansamout. There's plenty to do here. The children are in creche most of the evenings, after everyone's done fishing and crabbing and whatnot for the day. But it's clear that there's not a lot of entertainment.
Without knowing what it is we've done to provoke the Guardian's ire, Alabaster continues, it would be folly itself to go back to the Fulcrum. We might not even make it past the gates before somebody throws another disruption knife.
Which is obvious, now that Cyanite thinks it through. Yet there's something else that's obvious. Whenever she looks at the horizon and sees the smoking hump that is what's left of Alia, they think we're dead. She tears her eyes away from that lump, trying not to imagine what must have become of the beautiful little seaside calm she remembers. All of Alia's alarms, all their preparations, were shaped around surviving tsunami, not the volcano that has obviously, impossibly occurred instead. Poor Hera Smith. Not even Asael deserved the death she probably suffered. She cannot think about this. Instead, she focuses on Alabaster.
That's what you're saying, isn't it? Being dead in Alia allows us to be alive and free here?
Exactly,
Now Alabaster's grinning, practically dancing in place. She's never seen him so excited before. It's like he's not even aware of the price that's been paid for their freedom. Or maybe he just doesn't care.
There's hardly any contact with the continent here. And when there is, it's not exactly friendly. Our signed guardians can sense us if they're near enough. But none of their kind ever come here. These islands aren't even on many maps.
Then he sobers.
But on a continent, there'd be no question of us escaping the fulcrum. Every guardian east of Eumenes will be sniffing about the remains of Alia for hints as to whether we've survived. They're probably circulating posters bearing our likenesses to the Imperial Road Patrol and quartant militias in the region. I suppose I'll be made out as Misalem Reborn, and you, my willing accomplice. Or maybe you'll finally get some respect, and they'll decide you're the mastermind. Yes, well. He's right, though. With a calm destroyed in such a horrible way, the fulcrum will need scapegoats to blame. Why not the two Ragas on site, who should have been more than skilled enough to contain any seismic event between them? Alia's destruction represents a betrayal of everything the fulcrum promises the stillness. Tame and obedient origins, safety from the worst shakes and blows. Freedom from fear, at least till the next fifth season comes. Of course, the fulcrum will vilify them in every way possible, because otherwise people will break down its obsidian walls and slaughter everyone inside down to the littlest grit. It does not help that Cyan can sense, now that her Sesapine are no longer numb, just how bad things are in Alia. It's at the edge of her awareness, which is itself a surprise. For some reason, she can reach much farther now than she could before. Still, it's clear. In the flat plain of the maximal plate's eastern edge, there is a shaft burned straight down, down, and down into the very mantle of the planet. Beyond that, Cyan cannot follow. And she does not need to, because she can tell what made this shaft. Its edges are hexagonal, and it has exactly the same circumference as the garnet obelisk. And Alabaster is giddy. She should hate him for that alone. His smile fades as he sees her face. Evil Earth, are you ever happy? They'll find us. Our guardians can track us. He shakes his head. Mine can't. You remember the strange guardian in Alia alluding to this. As for yours, when your orogeny was negated, he lost you. It cuts off everything, you know, not just our abilities. He'll need to touch you for the connection to work again. You had no idea. He won't stop looking, though. Alabaster pauses. Did you like being in the fulcrum so much? The question startles her and angers her further. I could at least be myself there. I didn't have to hide what I am. He nods slowly, something in his expression telling her that he understands all too well what she's feeling. And what are you when you're there?
Fuck you!
She's too angry all of a sudden to know why she's angry.
I did.
His smirk makes her burn hot as Alia must be.
Remember, we've fucked Earth knows how many times, even though we can't stand each other, on someone else's orders. Or have you made yourself believe you wanted it? Did you need a dick? Any dick, even my mediocre, boring one, that bad?
She doesn't reply in words. She's not thinking or talking anymore. She's in the earth, and it's reverberating with her rage, amplifying it. The torus that materializes around her is high and fine, and leaves an inch-wide ring of cold so fierce that the air hisses and sears white for an instant. She's going to ice him to the Arctic and back. But Alabaster only sighs and flexes a little, and his torus blots out hers as easily as fingers snuffing a candle. It's gentle compared to what he could do, but the profundity of having her fury so swiftly and powerfully stilled makes her stagger. He steps forward as if to help her, and she jerks away from him with a half-voiced snarl. He backs off at once, holding up his hands as if asking for a truce. "Sorry," he says. He genuinely sounds it, so she doesn't storm off right then. "I was just trying to make a point." He's made it. Not that she hadn't known it before. That she is a slave, that all Ragas are slaves, that the security and sense of self-worth the Fulcrum offers is wrapped in the chain of her right to live, and even the right to control her own body. It's one thing to know this, to admit it to herself, but it's the sort of truth that none of them use against each other, not even to make a point, because doing so is cruel and unnecessary. This is why she hates Alabaster, not because he is more powerful, not even because he is crazy, but because he refuses to allow her any of the polite fictions and unspoken truths that have kept her comfortable and safe for years. They glare at each other for a moment longer. Then Alabaster shakes his head and turns to leave. Cyanite follows, because there's really nowhere else to go. They head back down to the cavern level. As they descend the stairs, Cyanite has no choice but to face the third reason she feels so out of place in Maeve. Floating now in the Calm's harbor is a huge, graceful sailing vessel. Maybe a frigate, maybe a galleon. She doesn't know either of these words from boat that dwarfs all the smaller vessels combined. Its hull is a wood so dark that it's almost black, patched with paler wood here and there. Its sails are tawny canvas, also much mended and sun-faded and watermarked. And yet, somehow, despite the stains and patches, the whole of the ship is oddly beautiful. It is called the Klalsu, or at least that's what the word sounds like to her ears. And it sailed in 2 days after Cyanite and Alabaster arrived in Maeve. Aboard it were a good number of the Calm's able-bodied adults, and a lot of ill-gotten gain from several weeks' predation along the coastal shipping lanes. The Klalsu has also brought to Maeve its captain, the headman's second, actually, who is only second by virtue of the fact that he spends more time away from the island than on it. Otherwise, Sine would have known the instant this man bounded down the gangplank to greet the cheering crowd that he was Maeve's true leader, because she can tell without understanding a word that everyone here loves him and looks up to him. Innan is his name. Innan Resistant Maeve in the mainlander parlance. A big man, black-skinned like most of the Maevites, built more like a strong back than a resistant, and with personality enough to outshine any Humanessin leader. Except he's not really a resistant or a strong back or a leader. Not that any of those use names really mean much in this Calm that rejects so much of Sanzit custom. He's an origin, a feral, born free and raised openly by Harless, who's a Raga too. All their leaders are Ragas here. It's how the island has survived through more seasons than they've bothered to count. And beyond this fact, well, Sion's not quite sure how to deal with Innan. As a case in point, she hears him the instant they come into the main entry cavern of the Calm. Everyone can hear him, since he talks as loudly within the caverns as he apparently does when on the deck of his ship. He doesn't need to. The caverns echo even the slightest sound. He's just not the sort of man to limit himself, even when he should. Like now.
Cyanite. Alabaster.
The calm has gathered around its